From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how one Milwaukee nonprofit is preparing for the possibility of AmeriCorps budget cuts.
Later, prolific and distinctive Wisconsin writer Jerry Apps offers a tour of his hundreds of acres in central Wisconsin.
Kyle Cherik explains what's appealing to chefs about creating pop-up dining experiences.
If they don't get this out, then a part of them will wither away and die. So it really isn't about turning it into the black. This is frivolity.
And the amazing experience is created by puppets and people on stage in Skylight's Beauty and the Beast.
You know, there's something inherently magical about puppets alone, but I think what's more exciting is when we have characters interacting with them. It sort of imbues them with power.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There's a lot of talk coming out of Washington these days, especially about what will change under the new presidential administration. Daily headlines can give us hints about which programs the Trump White House hopes to slash or alter, immigration and health care chief among them.
But many smaller programs also face imminent change, though they may not see as much attention in the media.
One of those programs is AmeriCorps, the public service work program for young people. Recent reports say the administration has considered cutting funds for AmeriCorps. That would impact the reach of some service organizations right here in Milwaukee.
One such group, College Possible, a nonprofit that pairs academic coaches with low-income students hoping to get to and through college. The organization relies on AmeriCorps for much of its funding.
Lake Effect's Rachel Morello sat down with College Possible's program director, Kelly Scher, and AmeriCorps member and coach, Ben Rangel, to chat about the work the group is doing now and how it could be impacted by a cut in federal funding.
A nonprofit like us applies to the federal government to be able to have AmeriCorps members come and serve for a specific term of service. Lots and lots of different things are able to get done through all of this energetic and wonderful work from AmeriCorps members who really want to give back. So the AmeriCorps member side of it is that they're looking for opportunities to be part of a community and giving back to communities and really working hard for some of the injustices and things that they would like to change in our country. And so can look at kind of a list of different opportunities of all those nonprofits and community-based organizations that are really working toward those things that they are most interested in.
So people who come to College Possible, core members that come to College Possible, what work are they doing in general?
In College Possible, we are working really to eliminate the degree divide. Low-income students right now in our country are only graduating at about an 11% from college with a bachelor's degree in 6 years. And so for us, that is absolutely an injustice. Because people come from a background that is low income doesn't mean that they shouldn't have the same opportunities as every other citizen in the United States. And so we are really working toward helping prepare students starting in high school, their junior and senior year. And then once they're in college, we're continuing to assist them navigate all the different challenges and loopholes and roadblocks that may come up when they're in college and may not know because they don't have other people in their life who have gone through it themselves. They can be there to really help kind of show which pathways are options and, you know, help guide them through that process of college till they get to that college graduation.
So, Ben, you are one of these coaches.
Yes.
You are a core member. Talk to me first about how you got involved with AmeriCorps, why you picked or how you got involved with College Possible, and then sort of some of the work that you're doing, because I know you said you're at Pulaski.
Yeah, certainly. So the reason I got involved was because the mission of College Possible resonated with me. So I was a low-income, first-generation college student myself. I remember meeting College Possible at a career fair when I was at UW-Madison as an undergrad. I was like, wow, I would have really benefited from having somebody help me through that process. So yeah, I was like, this seems like a great program. So I had no idea what AmeriCorps was. So this is what's interesting is I think that some people, either through a parent or somebody in their life, they learn early on what AmeriCorps means and what that is. So they look for terms of service within AmeriCorps. Other people like myself, they find a specific organization like College Possible, City Year, things like that, and they don't really know what AmeriCorps means. This is another thing I love about AmeriCorps in general is if you're a college graduate or you're about to be a college graduate, right, you spent 4 to 5 years learning all you can learn and doing as well as you can. And hopefully you took advantage of the career services. But a lot of my peers were like, what do we do now? And I think AmeriCorps and College Possible for me is a wonderful opportunity to just have that first job, that first experience outside of or after college graduation, and also have the opportunity to give back to your community. I don't know. It's one of the best decisions I've ever made, and I recommend it to everyone I talk to because it provides you with so much skill and networking capabilities. It's just a wonderful opportunity. Yeah.
You mentioned Teach for America. City Year was another one you mentioned. College Possible. I mean, these are big names in Milwaukee. A lot of people have interacted with people like you. You're here, obviously, because we're talking about funding and the possibility of some funding being lost on a federal level for AmeriCorps. How do you see your role in Milwaukee? And if you are to lose some funding, would that role completely disappear? Would it have to shrink? I mean, what are we talking about in terms of loss if this funding goes away?
Well, I can definitely speak to College Possible because it's something that we're absolutely thinking about and we have thought about for many years, actually, because this is really crucial for how our program works as it is. Because of that, we really wanted to make sure that if ever AmeriCorps funding would go away, that would not stop what we do. I can't speak for other agencies. And, you know, is it possible that it would really create some major gaps for agencies? Absolutely. So there are some organizations that rely on AmeriCorps in order to be able to fulfill their mission in a way that there's not really ability for contingency plans. So I'm just not sure what that would do for others. But at least for us, we know no matter what, we're going to continue serving our students. And we do have those plans in place.
Talk to me about what AmeriCorps funding pays for. Does it pay for somebody like Ben to do his full term of service?
So through part of the federal grant, there's a couple of things that we as the agency receive, and some of that is the funding that goes toward their living stipend. So every AmeriCorps member receives about $12,000 for the year for their annual living stipend, and it pays a portion of that, not completely, but a portion. The other thing that that allows is for all of the AmeriCorps members to receive directly from the federal government an education award when they've completed their term of service successfully. So every AmeriCorps member receives about $5,000, a little over that, that goes back to pay off loans that they may currently have, or it can pay forward into their grad school experiences or other continuing education opportunities that they seek out and find. That can be a huge benefit, and that's the only thing it can go for. So it really is also speaking a lot about education and how important it is for everyone to continue developing themselves and how important that higher education was and is for our country.
It's interesting how many different cycles this seems to be funding. It's funding people like you, Ben, coming out of college, going back into schools and helping people, and then yourself maybe going back into school or like Kelly saying, paying off loans. Maybe some of the kids that you work with through College Possible will become coaches later on. So I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second. Obviously, there's a trade-off, right? You're going to do this. You get that stipend. You get that education award. Those are great benefits of the program. But the opportunity cost there is a full-time job of some other sort, right, where it's not term limited. Maybe you have more opportunities to earn a different salary. So maybe people who are considering eliminating funding, that's something that's on their mind. We want kids to go right into the workforce. We want to broaden the economy in that way. Why is that not something that people should have on their mind? Like, why is this experience something that is so valuable to have?
Well, I guess one of the things that we know is that when our core members come in and it's their first professional workspace, there's a lot of skills that they're gaining when they work with us that if they were jumping into kind of a corporate world, there probably wouldn't be as much kind of training through it and supervision. We have very intense supervision in a great way. And so we're always talking about developing people at College Possible. It's all about developing who each individual is so that they're really gaining some of those skills and those professional opportunities. We find that the people who are core members with us, who are with us for that year, that 2 years, when they go, they are highly sought after, particularly if they're going into some sort of education realm that has aligned with us. So if they're going into higher ed, maybe it's a college that we've worked closely with for our students, they are already known by name by somebody who may be potentially hiring them. And so there is a great synergy with what their next step can be. That's great for us and that's great for them. That really works out wonderfully. In some ways, it may feel like, 1 year or 2 years of work lost, and yet those 1 or 2 years can propel them into kind of where they would have been 5 years if they really started at the very first point, walking in after a college graduation.
Ben, if AmeriCorps hadn't been an option for you, do you think you would still have tried to work with College Possible or an organization like it in some way? Or was that really a big catalyst for getting you to do the work that you do now?
I think that where College Possible is as an organization, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is highly dependent on AmeriCorps existing. The progress that we've had, the amount of cities that we're in, the amount of schools, I mean, that is because we have AmeriCorps in my mind. And I have friends all over the city of Milwaukee who are in similar AmeriCorps positions or not even similar, working in the healthcare field. And I know that a lot of their programming depends on AmeriCorps. So whether or not I would have done College Possible, I don't know if College Possible would have been an option for me without AmeriCorps.
If this funding cut is to happen at the federal level, what message do you guys think that that sends or would send?
I do think that it definitely says something about what people think about volunteering. Knowing how much that impacted my life, I immediately saw how amazing this was to be able to accomplish a mission and have that transformational experience for people who are looking for ways to contribute to the community. Especially when you're just coming out of college and you're like, well, I can't write checks to things, but I can contribute me. And by saying that it's not something that we believe enough in to fund is really challenging to kind of continue having everyone have that sense of we are a community together. No matter if your community is the country or globally, what does that really help people understand who their neighbor is?
Kelly Scher is Program Director for College Possible, and Ben Rangel is an AmeriCorps member serving as a coach through the organization. They spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello. You can read more about AmeriCorps on our website, WUWM.com.
We've spoken with Wisconsin writer Jerry Apps on this program before, but after a break, we will take you to his farm in central Wisconsin to learn how the landscape shapes his writing. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin native Jerry Apps is a prolific writer, from memoirs to novels. But more than just writing, Apps is a storyteller. His latest book is Never Curse the Rain, a farm boy's reflections on water.
While Apps' home base is Madison, where he taught for many years, he spends as much time as possible at his place in central Wisconsin, just a stone's throw from the farm on which he grew up.
Lake Effect's Susan Benz visited with Apps in that environment, talking with him about his father's influence and how Apps began to write as he recuperated from polio.
They set out for a tour of Apps' 120 acres aboard a John Deere Gator.
So we have probably three, four miles of trails. The year that we planted these, we planted 7,000 trees that year.
Oh my gosh.
And they are just lovely. They're
gorgeous.
They're doing really
gorgeous.
Well. There's a jack pine, that's native here. They're homely, twisted.
They are homely. Well,
tough
still,
as nails.
Yeah, homely in a beautiful way.
That's correct.
So 50 years you've been working this.
Yeah, the white pine really do well. I planted that one, that's a big one, white pine.
So Jerry, before you went into teaching, were you a writer all along, before you?
Yeah, it started with polio. And my inability, because I could hardly walk after recovering, to ever play any sports. And the coach had, at Wild Rose High School, seeing that I couldn't play baseball and basketball or anything else, he suggested that I might take typewriting. And typewriting in 1948 was for girls. And here I am sitting in a classroom of 15, 20 girls, all in front of L.C. Smith manual typewriters, learning how to type. Little did I know that the typewriting class was also the newspaper office for the Rosebud, name of our high school newspaper. And so I was immediately a reporter for the newspaper. By the time I was a senior, I was the editor. of the newspaper, writing all the editorials and most of the news articles because I could type. I was never censored. I really wrote every darn thing, anything you could think of. It was just great fun. I got so hooked on it.
I want to tell you about the Terminal Moraine and the last glacier. You see these big rocks?
Yep.
10,000 years old they are. This area was never, ever cultivated. It was like this 10,000 years ago. At least with the rocks, the vegetation would have been different. And look at the size of those rocks. Some of them are big as a Volkswagen car. And they're all different shapes and sizes. And they're just exactly where they've always been. Nobody's tried to move them. It gets a little hairy now, so
okay.
Hold on.
We won't talk.
Hold on. But the glacier did some really interesting things, including leaving behind hills like this. Here, by the way, is where the Native Americans, the Menominees, travel through, right between my legs now. See, there's the second pond right there. Now, this is a little tricky right here.
Okay.
We're driving by one of my pine plantations, which was planted probably in 1970, and we've thinned it two or three times, but it's one of my prized plantations. I have several around the farm, but this is a top-notch one.
And what makes it top-notch?
I guess it makes it, it's top-notch because I said it was.
Okay.
It's aesthetics. So sometimes when you're dealing with nature, the eye of the beholder is something to consider and find important. And what I think is absolutely beautiful, my neighbor might not have that idea at all, and that's fine. Well, you've just now had about the 50-cent tour. We're back out to the road.
Describe what this place looked like when you bought it.
It was a, in terms of the buildings, they were a disaster. The house had burned, and the remaining buildings, of which there was a granary and a pump house, were in terrible shape. In fact, they were in such terrible shape that the buildings had been taken off the tax rolls as worthless. And the land itself was considered, well, pretty near close to worthless because it's sandy and it's stony and it's hilly and all the rest of it.
You know, I'm thinking of moments in the book. For instance, you talked about not having water in the house while you were growing up, how important it was for your cattle, for the cows, and for the crops, and rough times that you went through praying and hoping that rain would come sort of in the nick of time, right?
Yes, and that one of the stories that I have in the book is the time when the windmill quit turning. Because it was the windmill that powered our pump and thus provided the water source for our cattle and horses and hogs and the family. And these, best I remember, it must have been about, 1938, 39, during the depths of the Depression. And at that time, central Wisconsin, it was experiencing a serious drought. And we had windstorms here that equaled any of the windstorms that they had in Oklahoma and Kansas and the southwestern states at that time. We had our own dust storms, and I remember my mother having to, it's like a talcum size dust that filtered in around the windows and covered all the dishes and everything. It was terrible. Well, the wind blew, of course, and then the windmill turned. But then one day the windmill stopped turning, and the pump thus stopped moving. And the cattle were soon without water. And one of the most awful sounds is that of cattle who are thirsty. And they don't just bellow in the daytime their unhappiness about not having water. But they do this all night long. And I heard that, and my dad heard that, and he waited, and the wind did not blow. And he looked at the western sky to see if a storm might be coming, and there was no storm coming. And so our neighbor, who was a half mile away, had purchased a gasoline engine sometime or another, and this gasoline engine powered his pump. And my dad called him on our party line telephone, and he said, his name was Alan Davis. He said, Alan, could we come down with some milk cans and get some water because our windmill has stopped turning and our cattle desperately need a drink? And so we went down to Alan Davis's place and we filled up, I don't know, 8-10 milk cans. They were 10-gallon milk cans with water, and hauled them up to the farm and dumped the water into the stock tank, and all the cattle had water and the horses had water, and we saved a little bit for ourselves. Shortly after that, my dad decided he didn't want to see that happen again, and he watched the ads in the farm newspapers for used, we never bought anything new, for the used gasoline engines, and he found one. And it was called a Monitor engine. And I've never forgotten the sound of it. It would go like this, go like kaboom, and then it'd go whoosh, 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 kaboom. And every time it would kaboom, the whole thing would shake and everything would shudder. But the pump jack went up and down and the water began flowing and we had water again.
You write about fishing with your dad when you had those rare times when you would take time off and go fishing. And then one day you had your own boat and took your dad fishing.
Well, the boats that we used when we went fishing with my dad were sorrowful things, I tell you.
You rented them for a few bucks.
Well, a few bucks, a dollar, $1. You could rent a leaking boat. They all leaked. Some just worse than others. You could rent a leaking boat for a dollar. If you wanted to fish for an hour, it was a dollar. If you wanted to fish all day, it was a dollar. All night, it's still a dollar. So the Andersons, Norwegian Lake, the other side of Wild Rose, they had these boats for rent. And then I have a story in the book about how we, on a kind of a drizzly, rainy day when Pa decided that we didn't have any work to do at home, we would go fishing. And so we're on this leaky boat. And I'll tell you what you did in those days is there were about four boats they had, and you'd look them over and you figure which one leaked the least. And we didn't successfully pick that one out that day because
you did a lot of bailing.
The thing, it came near sinking, and my brothers would tell me, "There you go, exaggerating again." Well, we didn't have a life vest. Ever heard of a life vest in those days? And anyway, we caught a lot of fish, and we didn't drown either. We made it. We made it home. Then I bought my own boat. Finally, I got an aluminum boat. One of the first things I bought when I had an extra dollar, which didn't happen for a very long time. 12-foot aluminum boat, still have it, wonderful boat. My dad and I did a lot of fishing with that boat. Now we're in Norwich.
With an APS motor.
Well, it had a one APS power motor. And people say, well, how did that work? I said, well, it works with two hands. You just grab the oars and you row. It's a one APS power motor.
So in the book, you talk about your dad having died when he was 93 and that you found solace here, sitting near one of your ponds.
Yeah, he died in the summer of, in July of 1993. And my mother had died the previous April. And so it was a tough time. And I was still working at the University of Wisconsin at that time. But upon his passing, I guess I would mourn differently than some folks, but I went down by my pond all by myself, and I just sat there. And it had to be one of those days when there was a little bit of, just a little drizzle of a rain. And the raindrops hitting on the pond, they were kind of a tinkling sound, like fine crystal that the wind might move. And I'm there listening and thinking about my dad, and watching the raindrops strike the water. And with each raindrop, a little circle forms. And it gets larger and larger, and then it disappears. And I thought, you know, life's a lot like that. We tend to make a little splash. My dad was not one to make a splash. At least he didn't think that was his purpose. I would see it very differently today. So that... That day was a very special day for me because I sat there for several hours just watching the pond and watching these circles as the raindrops struck the water and listened to that very special sound that raindrops make when they strike still water. I would just have loved to have had him. In fact, I would really wonder what he would have said. I've done 4-hour-long documentaries for Wisconsin Public Television, almost all of them about what farm life was like, related to the environment, nature-related. I think he would probably say, "Jerry, you're showing off again." I think that's what he would say. He is not one, you never see him standing up in front of a crowd. My gosh, if you put a microphone in front of him, he'd run the other way. That was not his way.
But he taught you about taking care of the land.
He did.
And
a lot of what my dad said was not with words. It was with actions. You knew what he had on his mind by what he was doing.
Writer Jerry Apps is professor emeritus at UW-Madison's College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, and he's a former teacher in the Department of Continuing and Vocational Education.
Lake Effect Susan Bentz visited him on his 120-acre property in central Wisconsin. Apps' most recent book is Never Curse the Rain, A Farm Boy's Reflection on Water. It's dedicated to his late father, Herman Apps. A public TV show on his work airs this evening on Milwaukee PBS.
Another quick break now, and then contributor Kyle Cherrett talks about the new crop of pop-up dining experiences coming to Milwaukee this spring. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Despite our recent snowfall, spring really is around the corner, and that means flowers and other plants will soon pop out of the ground.
And this spring, it'll also mean a return of a dining phenomenon that we showcased a few years ago, but has largely been dormant since, pop-up dining. Lake Effect food contributor Kyle Cherrick joins us to talk about their resurgence, which he says isn't necessarily because of a slowdown in new restaurant openings.
That would be the logical version of why this is happening. And that's what I thought at first as well. But in talking to all of the chefs that are doing this, the leitmotif is, with the exception of one, and I quote, "Otherwise we'd blow our brains out if we had to cook the same food every day." So it's that creative class of chefs and restaurateurs that are cooking, and they have their set menus and they have their new restaurants that are now open for a while. And they just want to tweak and play. And so they spin off and do pop-ups, basically, or some of the staff leave and they're still bartending or cooking here, but then they have their own series over here. And so it's really creativity and a need to stretch out beyond what they're already doing.
So are there enough people who are willing to go and do this thing that we don't really know? It's not a menu we're familiar with. It might be something really out there.
Yeah.
Are there enough people here? Are people finding it worth their while to do it?
I don't think it matters. One chef who I asked, I said, "So has it been a good thing creatively and financially viably?" And he said, "Creatively all day, financially viably, oh, not at all." And I don't want to say who in the groups we're going to talk about, but it's almost like they have their undergirding, their infrastructure of their regular restaurant. And if they don't get this out, then a part of them will wither away and die. So it really isn't about turning it into the black. This is frivolity. This is playtime. And that's why I go to these things. I don't expect a great meal, though I hope to have one. I don't expect impeccable service, though I hope that's there. I just want to see what they're going to do. I want to see if they can pull it off. I want to go for the playtime, too. And if I leave and I still need a burger, meh, that's not the point.
So do you think that a lot of these folks will take what they learn in the pop-up, that kind of explosive creativity, and maybe put it back into their more day-to-day, their quotidian menus, as it were?
I think no question. Okay. I think no question. So in the case of one, they're hoping to move towards a restaurant. So this is the let's get it right. Let's play in a different way before we are constrained. And then let's move towards the training wheels coming off. In the case of another, she never wants a restaurant. She just wants to keep pushing her type of cuisine and these crazy fun beer pairing pop-ups and to hell with everything else or to heck with everything else. In the case of another, it's pure creativity and they've already got the financial backing and other things. So if it never really goes to the black, who cares? We can cook at this level, so we should. And in the case of a fourth, they're so tied into the wedding catering what everybody else wants, because that's what their clients, I mean, that's their business. I want my cake this way. I want my hors d'oeuvres this way. I want the main to be this way. I want that they just want to do what they want to do. And it's such a relief for them. But at the very heart, they're creative cooks and chefs. So they got to do it. You know, it's
They want to do what they want to do, but they also want to invite people to enjoy it with them.
Absolutely. It would be, that is the other leitmotif. This would be no fun if no one else was there. The difference between chefs and cooks as compared to musicians is that musicians can have a perfectly grand evening just jamming for other musicians. Chefs and cooks need us to come in and enjoy their food as well.
Well, you mentioned four. This is all happening soon.
This
right?
is all happening soon. This is springtime. Yeah, and there's links, obviously. And a tale of caution. These folks are kind of not fly by night, but it's not the tightest website. Don't expect open table. You got to go to their Facebook page and dig a little bit. So Beatrix, absolutely love her concept. Melanie traveled around the country, bit of an army brat, had family in Iowa, a connection to a farm there, has been a vegetarian for as long as she can remember. On the farm in Iowa, the chickens had names, quote unquote, from her. And in traveling around the country, she had great vegetarian food everywhere and came to Milwaukee for love and saw this paucity of great vegetarian cooking. And so the tagline to Beatrix is, you know, rabbit food for people. So she does these pop-ups and it's family style. It's delicious. The next one coming in on the 23rd of March, I think, they're pairing with a Chicago female brewer who is also a vegan brewer. What that means, Bonnie, I have no idea. Welcome to the world of pop-ups. But that's the great thing. Like, I want to go because I want to see what that means in a culinary aspect.
Yeah.
And if it rocks, that's amazing. If it isn't quite to my taste, who cares? I had a new dining experience. She's got terrific posters that you might see around town. And they're always very playful and sort of Alice in Wonderland looking or, you know,
now,
Bunny
is she
X'd.
The one who doesn't want a restaurant? Or?
To the best of my knowledge, she doesn't want a restaurant.
So she just wants to keep doing this
kind of
thing.
Just keep doing this, yeah. Why take the fun out of it? Why add in hassle? Why add in overhead and, you know, all these other things? And she finds great veggies, and then she gets creative with what she can do with them. And then she does, you know, two or three events in 2 or 3 months, and everybody's happy, and she's happy, and the creative flame continues going, and that's the heart of a pop-up.
Okay.
So sprezzatura, which in Italian, it means a kind of a disheveled elegance, a uncontrived look that looks so perfectly put together. And it's really used in menswear more than anything. So the late CEO of Fiat was notorious for wearing his tie with the back, you know, band of it longer than the front wide part. And that was one of his moves. He wore his watch on the outside of his shirt cuff because to him it seemed superfluous to have to slide that back to look at the time. All of those little aspects are sprezzatura, the rumpled scarf, the so on and so forth. So they embody this really elegant, modern, contemporary Northern Italian aesthetic in their cuisine.
I was going to say elegant without being fussy.
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it might be a perfectly poised cuisine, a brilliantly balanced aperitif that is set in front of you, kind of ramshackle on a large family-style plate. That's sprezzatura. And they get even deeper than that. I mean, the last one that they did, it was really sort of a dark room with one light shining down onto a pillar. That demonstrated the aspect of that theme. They always pick a theme. The one that's coming up is the bitter embrace. It's all about the great Italian bitters, the aperitivos, the amaros, think Negroni and Boulevardier and things like that, and Fernet, but in their more raw form or mixed in new ways and paired with I don't know how many courses. And they're doing that at Phoenix Cocktail Club because that's a good place to do it.
Well, you mentioned Dandan, and
yeah.
one of them is actually happening
yeah.
within
yeah.
Dandan.
Within Dandan.
This is another kind of pop-up.
Yeah, yeah. You could go there as a regular and never know that this wonderful little concept called Esterev, which is a portmanteau of the two owners, Dan and Dan, of their grandmothers, Evelyn and Esther. Esterev, right? Mm-hmm. I know. I mean, it do just
That's
gets
so
you
sweet.
Right there. Yeah.
yeah.
But they're both, I mean, you know, Van Wright's been semifinal for the James Beard a bunch of times. Dan Jacobs is one of the finest cooks in the city. He's some of the heart and soul of Odd Duck and Wolf Peach when it first opened. And they're just so darn talented. And I love their Chinese fusion cuisine, but they needed to paint in other areas. So they pulled together this concept that's in a sort of a side back room called Esterev. It's only, I believe, on Friday and Saturday nights. It's prefix. It's 13 courses, although really 14 with the intermezzo. And you need to do a reservation. There's wine pairings that go with it. And then poof, it's gone. You have that dinner and you're completely separate from Dandan. And they do it twice a week. And if they sell four spots or if they sell, I don't know, a capacity, it's probably 22 or 25, it still happens because they need to buzz that creative, you know, motion inside themselves.
So that's kind of a pop-up, but it isn't because it's happening more regularly.
Right, okay. right. It's a stationary subversive pop-up is what I would call that.
Okay.
And then last but not least is Ball and Biscuit Catering, which is a catering operation. And they do weddings and rehearsal dinners and all manner of corporate events and that sort of thing. And they have a what I would really just call a showroom space kind of over in the Brewers Hill area. And they have this menagerie of great cupboards and tables and chairs and plates and all, again, sort of that Alice in Wonderland kind of rustic Victorian nothing matches aesthetic. So their showroom, about four times a year, based on their whims and based on their schedule and based on seasons and events and holidays, they pull together a theme. I think this one that's coming up is just going to be Easter. And they rock out a dinner, and it sells to 30, 40, 50. I don't even know what their, you know, capacity is. And it is what it is. It's six courses, it's three courses, it's this, it's that. It's all around a theme. And you're in their space, and you're eating off all these great plates and unmatching silverware and so on and so forth. And the beauty of all of these, even in the case of Esterev, because the menu changes so frequently, is that this dinner will never happen again. You can never recreate this experience.
Lake Effect food contributor Kyle Cherik is the host of Public Television's Wisconsin Foodie.
We will take one last break, and then the magic created on stage in Skylight Theater's new production of Beauty and the Beast. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Most of us might be familiar with the Disney version of Beauty and the Beast, but the opera of the same name, staged by the Skylight Theater Company, is an entirely different spectacle based on the original darker fairy tale. The 18th century light opera is a unique reimagining featuring dance and larger-than-life puppetry.
James Ortiz is the director as well as the scenic and puppet designer for Beauty and the Beast, and he came to Milwaukee from New York to put his talents to the test. Most recently, Ortiz was the recipient of the 2016 Obie Award for Puppet Design for his critically acclaimed off-Broadway show, The Woodsman.
He and Skylight prop director Lisa Schlenker joined forces to build and design puppets for Beauty and the Beast, and Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski went down to the Skylight Theater to meet them and the puppets they created.
James and Lisa, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for allowing me to meet you here amongst the puppets.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So to start, what came first, the decision to do the opera or the desire to do puppets for a show?
What a great question. It's like chicken or the egg. I was approached about a year ago about doing this show after the head of Opera Saratoga, because, of course, this show is a co-production between this opera company and one in upstate New York. And the plan is that in the summer we'll be doing this show there also. Different cast, whole new thing. But I was approached by him. He had saw a show that I had done in New York, which had a great deal of puppetry and straight acting and sort of an odd blend, sort of hard to explain in a couple of words. But he was sort of like, we have this really odd old opera that is usually sort of stuck in children's theater world, And I'd love to like talk about trying to figure out a fresh take on it. Do you have anything? And I was like, well, send it to me. Let me listen to it. And the first time I heard it, I was not entirely sure where to go. Also, it was all in French, so I really was struggling. But I read through the script, and we sort of talking, and I sort of went, I think there's a fun opportunity here for puppetry and acting, and, you know, there's something inherently magical about puppets alone, but I think what's more exciting is when we have characters interacting with them. It sort of imbues them with power, and it just makes everything more heightened and magical.
I think part of where the magic in puppetry is for me and for the folks that I work with who've been building with us is that connection to that childlike suspension of disbelief that we all want to bring in to opera and music theater when we come in and see a piece of work like that on stage. But puppetry just transports us there immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's a joy to see that on stage. And it's a joy to build that type of prop and that type of puppet.
A comment you made before when you were doing your first puppetry production was that there's also something inherently eerie about puppetry. And I imagine there's tapping into that component for this show because the beast here, your rendition, it's kind of reminds me more gargoyle-like compared to what we've seen in the past.
Not the Disney version.
Exactly, not the Disney version. So what components of this opera did you want to be expressed in your puppets?
That's a great question. I mean, you mentioned sort of the darkness and the eeriness, and I think actually the story is quite, it's not clean. It's not one thing. It's not just a one-note Disney situation. I mean, we have a story about a girl who gets sold by her father to live in a house with a monster. Let's talk about that. Let's not pretend that's not the story, you know? And then in order to save his and his own family's life. And then, of course, she's a prisoner, even though she may not think that she is, or he tries to make her feel like she is. There's a lot of like uncomfortable layers that are here that are very present in any grim fairy tale and very present in every sort of original folk tale. For me, it was more about embracing all of those things, right? And I think in terms of like how to sort of put all those things in the show itself is a weird hodgepodge of bizarro things. It's an opera, but there's also a great deal of spoken text in it, which is sort of, it's a proto-musical. It was in the 1700s, and it's one of the first, it's on the way to what we would later turn into a musical. The songs come when characters need to express emotion. There's also ballet dance. It's also, if you break apart the story, we have a family drama, we have a love story, we have high comedy, we have low comedy, we have
a morality tale.
We have a high fantasy. We also have a very intimate, high stakes thriller at certain moments. It's too many. So it was literally like me going, I have no idea how to put any of these things together. I was just sort of going, this is such a weird piece. I don't know what to do. And then, not to get too long into this, but the way that this opera has been described, you know, it sort of falls under different categories of opera, right? And I'm not going to say all the French correctly, but it's sort of this, it means a comedic opera with dance and music, brawl. And you go, what does that mean? So kind of just taking that, you know, sort of like, right, all of these different things don't have to go together. The point is that they're making this cacophonous, beautiful collage. And in the Beast puppet, it became sort of, that was the best, he became the mascot of that, you know. He is, there's goat part, and there is gorilla part, and there is bird, and there is a reptile, and a lot of sort of looking at a lot of sort of Baroque architecture and Baroque armor, and just kind of going, let's put it all in. And that was sort of the point.
And then putting on top of that the personality and the heart mm-hmm. into the design as well as into the puppeteering
Absolutely.
Of it.
Well, and I imagine there is an extra complication versus a stage play with puppets. Now we have an opera with puppets.
Yes.
And it looks like you need at least several people to operate the beast. So adding the component of not only acting but singing with puppets and having multiple people, how do you bring all those together to sink in and express one character together?
A lot of rehearsal.
We actually, generally opera rehearsal is quite short by comparison to sort of straight theater, mostly because the performers are so prepared. They come in day one off book and they know all the music and everything. So it's more of a question of sort of staging. But in this case, because the puppetry is so integral, we started about 3 days earlier and I just had those puppeteers and some of the people in those scenes. And I just sort of warned the actors, the actress playing our beauty and the actor playing the voice of the beast. It's going to be a lot of work and we're going to be sort of hold please and, you know, taking our time. And, you know, before anything, we sat around a table and read through the whole scenes and went, okay, hold, let's stop and talk about this and where the beat changes and what does he want in every moment and really kind of throwing a verb on it to shame, to love, to kiss. What is he doing in that moment? And until we got all four puppeteers plus the voice actor to sort of agree on one thing, which was not difficult to do, I should say. They're all wonderful. But it was a thing of everybody in the room going, oh, I see. And they all started advocating for the character and all started loving that character, which that's the most vital thing to do, especially when you're going to be stuck inside of a big foam body.
Yes. Well, and you mentioned those different types of emotions. So going into the design of the puppet, what did you want in its head, its arms, its shoulders to express those things subtly? How did you design it from paper to what we have in front of us?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, we knew that, of course, he has to be imposing. First of all, more than anything else, he needs to be imposing, right? He needs to, the first time you see him, you need to see what the other characters in the play see, which is yikes. And then we need to find something else in there. So, you know, it was easy to kind of make something big look frightening. That's not the difficult part. The other thing is going, what else can he do? So we did some very subtle things, and you know, we could have really tricked out him even more, but it wasn't necessary. He has a great deal of range of motion in his head, which gives him a lot of options. His mouth moves, and also he has a little action in his ears, which actually does most of the work for us. In another version, there could have been eyebrows and eyelids and all kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, it's not necessary. And he has one little extra thing because he walks on all fours like a gorilla. He has front forearms that are quite heavy. And we gave him fingers that can open and touch, very sort of Michelangelo Sistine Chapel stuff, because we just needed him to have some gentle contact with her. And if that was the way, then that was it. But beyond that, it's actually, it's just the puppeteers filling it in different ways.
I think one of the things that helps the puppeteers do that job of inhabiting, the four of them working together as a team to inhabit the beast, is the range of motion in the other joints. Mm-hmm. So the torso is, you know, supported by two puppeteers, one of whom is piloting the head, which is where the bulk of the character nuance happens, the other of whom is piloting the back legs. Then there's a puppeteer outboard on each of the massive forearms that also work the wrist and finger point. And for all of those joints, we tried to get them as humanly articulated as possible, because I think that level of recognition, subliminal recognition on the part of the audience, that there's some human movement in the shoulder, in the elbow, in the hip, in the leg. I think that conveys a sense of life, and it really helps the puppeteers do their job.
Absolutely. And even in some of the details of sort of the face sculpt, you know, I was talking to you about this, of this thing of like, we need to make a face that can be the 2 to 5 different emotional extremes that he has in the show. So it's a bizarre thing, because you're kind of, what does that mean? Are you sculpting a blank face? Not really. You're sculpting things that have forms in them that can help you go from one extreme to the other, just by how they fill it.
Right.
Yeah. By them going inside of it tells you so much. And you're seeing the brows change and you're seeing the eyes widen, and which is not happening.
And the two of you as a team really put in all the elements of the show together, from stage directing, scenic design, puppets, props. What kind of things did you want to either complement the puppets, or did you build the set around the puppets, or was it the other way around? Because to have them as the main character, that's where the audience's eyes are for the most part. But all those other elements, how did you brainstorm and decide how you wanted it to have a layout and a feel?
Yeah, I feel like it was the story first more than anything else, because I feel like the puppets are there to be extraordinary. You know, their purpose, you know, it's like that thing of you can't go to Oz if you don't spend some time in Kansas first. So we needed to really ground the world and make all the characters make as much human sense as possible inside of a very heightened opera, you know. So it actually was sort of creating a space that could be the playground for the actors to do the entire show in, and then making sure, by the way, that the puppetry can fit inside of it. The puppetry should always feel a little other, you know. You know what I mean? It should always feel a little, that's the Oz, that's the extra. And if the world is as grounded as possible and we're not playing fairy tale, we're not playing Pinkies Up, you know, but really meaning it, then when he arrives, it's all the more extraordinary. Do you know what I mean?
I think Shima Orens did some beautiful costumes also that just are the icing on the cake of fitting everybody as their characters into this world and being that bridge between the scenic reality of this viney, decaying ruin environment and the heightened fantasy of the puppets. I think that costume design that Shima did really bridges that.
Do you think there's also something just about the story, Beauty and the Beast, that makes it user-friendly, so to speak, for puppets, because it is about transformation, so it's kind of a natural fit to just experiment with it?
Totally, 100%. I think, you know, normally this opera is done with an actor wearing a mask, sort of like a gargoyle-y face, and then he takes it off in the last moment, and that's how he's the prince. And you go, sure, that's an option. I think since it is about transformation, I also think a lot of it is about embracing otherness and embracing, I mean, maybe something for now, embracing that which is alien, embracing that which is
somewhat frightening.
Frightening and something that we immediately feel we should shun. It's interesting in sort of fleshing out the characters of Zamir's sisters, who are completely horrifyingly opposed to a lot of change. There's something really exciting about that being what the story is about. It's about facing your fears and growing up and all of the above. And actually, I think, as schmaltzy as this is, I think it's about the transformative power of love.
I think that's the perfect way of describing it. Yeah. And these are epic topics in proportion to many stories that we tell on stage. Yeah. And I think opera lends itself to the epic. It lends itself to the power, and puppetry also lends itself to the epic fantasy version.
I think so too.
James Ortiz is the director, as well as the scenic and puppet designer for Skylight Theater's Beauty and the Beast. Lisa Schlenker is the prop director for Skylight. The show premieres tomorrow night, and it runs through March 26th. You can find out more about the show, as well as see video and photos of the Beast puppet in action at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.